aren't a whole lot of songs out there that refer to the Old Testament, but that's one of them, and it's a good one. Andrew Peterson, what a songwriter. Pillar of Fire, the name of the tune. At 13 minutes after the hour, it's a Tuesday morning. We're Broken Road Radio, and joining us now from Garden Valley, Texas, Dr. Don Clark. Don is a biochemist and a member of the Board of Creation Moments, and he's with us after journeying across Louisiana. How was the trip, Don?
Oh, the trip was trip was fine. We had a lot of rain while we were there, mm-hmm. at least while we were in Baton Rouge, but we were inside most of the time. But I also, one of my aunts, well, my aunt died. Mm. On Thursday, we left on Saturday, and so the funeral was on Monday, so I stayed an extra day, and was able to go to her funeral, which was on the west bank of New Orleans. Mm-hmm. So, got to see some cousins that I hadn't seen probably in over 25 years.
That's the home territory for you, isn't it?
Well, that's where, I was born and raised in Jefferson Parish, not too far from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And left to go to school at LSU Baton Rouge. That's where I met my wife after spending some time at LSU. And then after I graduated from LSU, I kind of went to one side of the country to the next. Mm-hmm. I went to Florida for a while, and I went to California for a while, then up to Philadelphia for a while.
That's what young people are supposed to do. That's what David did in his when he was a callow youth. Didn't you, David? You wandered aimlessly for some time, didn't you?
I did. Yeah. I wandered aimlessly.
California, Massachusetts.
Sometimes aim fully. Sometimes I just went where I was told to go.
Okay. David, go home, they would say, and you'd head out of town.
So it might have seemed aimless from the outside, people just looking at my situation, but as far as I was concerned, I was following orders.
Well, there was a madness to your method then, and apparently the same thing happened to me too, kind of, but I did my wandering in the Marine Corps. They told me to go here, go there.
I spent my service, my military experience.
What did you say? You were in the Air Force. You were in the Air Force, David.
But the mind was a blank there. I couldn't think of the synonym for military.
Well, you could just say you were in service, because you were in service to your country. It just wasn't particularly military, that's all.
Didn't that always sound like, that in service means that that your generator is on?
That's like the elevator that's working is in service.
The one that's in service,
Well, Dr. Don is the author, I tell you, of something that we have laughingly referred to heretofore as the theory of devolution. And we really didn't laugh at the theory so much as just the notion that it rhymes with the theory of evolution, and it contradicts the theory of evolution at every count, the theory of devolution. And now here we have an article that purports to present research that confirms Dr. Don's theory of devolution. And Don, all I can say is they don't make them like they used to.
Don, this is kind of semi off the topic, and far be it for me to do such a thing, but I seem to remember that you had difficulty with the term devolution when we first started talking about it, and this was back when I think we were talking about the Etsy, the guy, the 5,000-year-old guy that was found in the Alps
4 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was some time ago. Mm-hmm.
And it seemed that you were not all that eager to gravitate towards the term. Is that right, or is my mind continuing towards scrambled eggs?
Yes.
Well, if you're
both can be true here.
Is continuing in that direction. I think my mind is too, because I don't remember that part of the conversation.
Okay. All right.
We'll have to go back and listen to the tapes.
And you still haven't published the term of the theory of devolution.
Well, there needs to be a book, a scientific paper on the theory of devolution.
Yeah, that's right. I think creation book, The Theory of Devolution.
Mm-hmm. I'll send her out this afternoon. Okay.
Well, I put a link in the chat window at Broken Road Radio, and it's a link to the article that we're talking about, which is at ICO.org. That's the Institute for Creation Research. And it talks about the headline, the title is, well, first of all, it's by Jeffrey Tompkins, who's a PhD, and writes, "A new study confirms harmful role of mutations." Now, when we say the word mutations, most of us think of grotesque creatures like Dr. Moreau's Island and Mysterious Island and mad scientists and things. But what kind of mutations are we talking about here, Don?
Well, we're talking about the mutations in the DNA, the deoxyribonucleic acid. This is the information library in your cell. And if you've taken biology at all in recent times, then you would know about DNA. You would know about that, hey, DNA codes for all your proteins in your cell, for example. DNA contains the information that tells the cell, well, I need more of this protein, or shut down this other manufacturing of this protein. So it contains information about expression of genes. And so any in the DNA is made up of nucleic acids, that is nucleic acid bases, and there's four different types of nucleic acid bases that are made up that the DNA is made from. So you've got four possibilities for coding a particular amino acid, let's say, in a protein. Well, over time, what happens is that you had a nucleic acid that had a certain sequence, then you might, as it's replicating, for example, it might substitute incorrectly one base for another base.
And replicating happens when a cell divides, correct? That's what we're talking about.
Yes, when the cell divides, then you know it. You might introduce errors into the process. And a matter of fact, this study actually looked at that, and it's been known actually the rate of mutation, which brings us back to devolution. Mm-hmm. It's been, studied with not only different animals, but humans as well, as to how much mutations are introduced into the DNA, or how much substitution of these nucleotides within the DNA, takes place over time, and then you can get a rate of mutation with time. And this study did was it looked at that rate of mutation and the amount of mutation, and it correlated it with cancer. So they looked at individuals from across the globe, really. This wasn't a micro study. It was a global study. They took tissues from people in 80 different regions across the globe. Now, why did they do that? Well, one, they were looking to see, hey, is the possibility of cancer, is that related to these mutations, or is it an environmental effect? Mm-hmm. That is, we live in America, and there's pesticides all over the place and all kinds of chemicals because we're an industrial nation. They also took samples, let's say, from a country that's not quite, from people that is not developed, and you don't have all of the pollution that we have, let's say, in the United States. Mm-hmm. And other areas where it's even more polluted. What they found was quite interesting. So you're trying to separate, is it an environmental factor, or is it this mutation problem in the DNA that is causing these cancers? What they found, that 80% of the cancers from these individuals, 80% was correlated with the number of mutations that they had. So, in other words, the more mutations that you have in particular in your stem cells, and we'll talk about stem cells in a minute, but the more mutations you have in your stem cells, the higher your risk of having cancer. And so they looked, like I said, at the epidemiology, the aspect of it. Does the environment have an effect? Apparently, environment plays a very little role, if any, in the greater propensity to yardstick. So
that would rule out things like climate or water or diet or exercise. All those human variables are now shoved aside to look at this one factor, which seems to have a strong correlation. Now, correlation is not the same as proof, though, is it?
It's not. There could be other things that might explain it, but the correlation was apparently very high, and like I said, 80%. Mm-hmm. 80% of the cancers were correlated with the number of mutations in the stem cells of these individuals. Now, what are stem cells? I mean, we've heard a lot about, stem cells being kind of the miracle cells in our body and causing all kinds of cures for people by injecting, stem cells. Well, stem cells are cells that are responsible for repairing tissue in your body. And stem cells are found in pretty much all the tissues of your body. And when you have an injury in a particular organ, let's say, the stem cells are kind of responsible for repairing the damage, because these stem cells are non-differentiated cells that kind of reside in your normal cells and in various parts of the tissue, and they get activated when there's damage. And if it's in a heart cell, for a heart muscle, for example, they would get activated and say, "Oh, we need to make some more heart muscle," or "We need to make some more liver tissue," or whatever it happens to be. Then they differentiate at that point in time into that tissue, which that in itself, I mean, that is amazing.
It's like every cell has its own brain, almost, something that senses conditions and makes decisions accordingly.
Right. And, anyway, and there's new procedures. I was reading recently about new medical procedures where they would take stem cells out of your fat cells, isolate the stem cells, and then re-inject it into your body. And people, for example, that have had stroke almost get completely better by those stem cells going to the damaged areas, let's say in your brain, and repairing the damage. I mean, this is it's amazing what these stem cells can do. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this research showed that the higher the mutations in your DNA in these stem cells, the greater propensity that you would have, let's say, for cancer in that individual. And that kind of makes sense, because, like I said, these stem cells are non-differentiated cells, so they start off kind of looking like cancerous cells. That cancer cells are non-differentiated cells, and they kind of take over your body. But stem cells obviously have some control. But if the more mutations you build up in these non-differentiated cells, then the possibility of them going rogue, for example, would make sense that, that's going to cause a problem, later on during life. And it's interesting, because the other aspect is that they found that every time these stem cells divide, about three mutations occur. So the more division you have in these stem cells, then the more mutations you're building up in the cells, and hence the more problems you might have, you know, later on. So now this correlates mutation with something that's not good. I mean, I think we would all agree that cancer is mm-hmm. not a benefit to mm-hmm. the organism, the organ, the individual that has cancer.
And you have to wonder too about how many other maladies might be brought on to one degree or another by these mutations, not just cancer, but it could be any number of degradations to the human condition.
Well, exactly. And I was doing debate one time with an evolutionary biologist, and one of the persons in the audience, for example, showed that sickle cell anemia was a benefit. That was a positive mutation, example of a positive mutation. Hmm. And, you know, I replied, well, how in the world is sickle cell anemia a positive mutation? That is, it has a positive benefit to the individual who has it. Because sickle cell anemia, if it's not treated, when your blood cells turn into needles, essentially, can die. You know, mm-hmm. so that doesn't seem to be a very beneficial thing. And he says, oh, well, because the person that has that can withstand malaria. They have a better chance of surviving malaria. And you know, it's a benefit to the organ, to the individual. Mm-hmm. And indeed, it's a death-threatening disease or mutation. It has no benefit to the individual. So the evolutionists try to use, you know, these things to point to, you know, the benefits and how this indeed points to evolution. But in fact, you know, the more we look at this, the more mutations we look into, the more we find that this is not a benefit to the individual. It's very deleterious to the individual. And so it would be better if... you know, we could either slow down the mutation process or, you know, stop it altogether. But, of course, we haven't discovered a way of doing that.
Well, is it true that the theory, which I would refer to as a hypothesis, not yet at theory status, but the notion of evolution maintains that these mutations are positive, that they maybe adapt a species or a family of creatures so that they can live longer, live better, survive where other competing forms of life cannot. Is that the essence of evolution, that these mutations are good things, positive things?
Well, that's the... that's the driving force for the hypothesis of mm-hmm. evolution, is that, oh, you know, over millions and millions of years, you know, cells acquired mutations which gave them new traits, and these new traits, some of them were beneficial to the individual, and therefore got carried on to the offspring, and the offspring looked different than the parent. We know now that that is a completely fallacious argument, and that the mutations that we are seeing are not creating new traits for individuals. That is, let's say some people have certain mutations in their brain cells, and therefore they've got better memories. Well, you know, we're finding that as we go along here in life, that memories don't get better; they get worse. And we're not passing on the ability to, you know, process information to a greater degree, but in fact, we're probably overall getting dumber. And that Adam himself was, Adam and Eve, of course, were individuals that had tremendous brain capacity, and you know, we've seemed to be losing that as we go along with time.
You know, it's long been said, and this is popular knowledge. I don't know if it's really true, but that we only use about 10% of our brains, and that's always suggested to me that like, hey, what a waste. How can you turn on the other 90%? Wouldn't we like to do that? This suggests that maybe if we go back far enough in time, before there were all these mutations, maybe before mutations began, that we used our entire brain. Otherwise, why have it?
Unless it's a receptacle for other type of, spiritual information, for mm-hmm. example.
Well, in that case, the assumption that we're only using 10% is an error. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
That's an error.
Proposed that Einstein, who was a great thinker, obviously used more than 10% of his brain, and that's why he came up with the theory of relativity. Some people have better abilities than others, and obviously some people are smarter than others, but as a population as a whole, I think if we could measure that, if we had the ability way back in the early days of measuring the brain capacity of folks, or the mental capacity, if you will, we would probably find that our great 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 ancestors as a population as a whole were smarter than we are today. Now, that's a guess. The only evidence that I have that would be indeed the case is, some of the fantastic structures that man built in the past, but also the historic record that is in Genesis. Because here you had an individual, Adam, whose first job was to name all of the animals on the earth at the time. To name all of the animals, and apparently he did it in one day. And how do we know that he did it in one day? Well, because on the sixth day, at the end of chapter 1 in Genesis, it says that God created man in his own image. He created them male and female. So he created man and woman on the same day, the sixth day. But on chapter 2, we understand that man was created first, and that woman was taken out of man only after Adam, for example. God gave him his first task, which was to name all of the animals. And then after he did that, Adam then had a desire for a mate, because while he was naming the animals, he saw that the animals had a partner, so that they came in pairs. There was a male and then there was a female. And so he looked at a deer and named a deer and saw that there were two of them. The lions and all these other animals that were brought to Adam to name. So he said, okay, well, where's my mate? And then, God puts him to sleep. And of course, we know the story. Takes out a rib and forms Eve out of the rib from Adam, and creates a mate. Well, that apparently happened on the first day, on day six of creation. So naming at that time, there probably was 20 to 25,000 different animals, for example, on the earth, or different kinds of animals that Adam was going to name. So that had to be a pretty quick process.
And you've maintained before that this was not a random process. This isn't just making up a sound to represent that animal, but the name somehow captures the essence of that animal.
The name had the characteristics of that animal. So he had to remember. So he names an animal, right? He names a kind of animal, and then when another animal is brought to him, for example, he had to remember the previous name, because you can't name, you know, two animals the same, and then name the other animal. Well, you know, after about, you know, maybe 10 or 20 of those, we would be struggling to come up with something unique, you know.
Well, I'm thinking at some point, Eve would have looked at him and said, nope, you used that one already. Pick something else.
She wasn't around.
She was a helper, though. I mean, she was a helper. She had a clipboard, and she kept him in line. And it's been that way ever since.
Yeah, there you go. That was after the fall.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, my point is that at least in Genesis, for example, the early chapters of Genesis, it suggests that that Adam had tremendous mental abilities that we don't seem to have today. Hmm. Now, it's interesting, if you look at this genetic or mutation rate, you know, in the human race and in the animals, and you use that rate to calculate, okay, we know what the mutation rate is. We know what the human genome is now. We've sequenced it. We have that, you know, in our databases. So we know what that is. Let's go back and calculate how long has man been around? And the answer to that, and the animals for that matter, how long has man and the animals been around? When, based on the mutation rate. So you take the mutation rate and you say, okay, sometime back in history, there was no mutations. When was that? Mm-hmm. Now, you would expect that answer would be millions and millions of years based on the age of the Earth, for example. The Earth was 4.5 million years old. Older than that, obviously, or what was it, 4.5 billion years old. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, that would mean that, you know, man, you know, came around and the animals were here long before man and the dinosaurs and all this. So the answer to that question should be in the hundreds of millions of years. But it's not. It's between 4 to 10,000 years. So using the rate of mutation, which we know now, you know, per generation, we then go back and calculate. And what we find, and we talked about this in one program, I don't remember how many years ago, but we find that that age fits very, very nicely to the age that the Bible describes as to how long ago all of this took place. That is, when the earth was formed, back in Genesis chapter 1, and the genealogy that one gets out of Genesis, that recorded genealogy, which states that, hey, you know, this earth is less than 10,000 years for sure, and more like 6,000 years ago. That's exactly the same age that you get for, you know, humans as well as others, other animals.
Well, that fits, example, that fits the Bible narrative of there being a beginning and sin entering the world and kicking off that mutation process. But I suppose an evolutionist could say, well, it takes you back 4 to 10,000 years, but there must have been then a very long period when there were no mutations.
Yeah, but what you'd have to argue, what's the stability in what event happened to cause these mutations to start where there weren't.
That's a valid question. What was that event?
Well, we know that, you know, we know that, for example, the age of man, again, going back to the Bible as a history source and going back to Genesis, the age of man declined, you know, very, very rapidly, let's say, after the flood. The average age before the flood was over 900 years old. And then after the flood, it degraded very rapidly until you get to, you know, Abraham, for example, you know, Moses, we know Moses lived 120 years, but it declined to 70 or 80 within, 30 to 40 generations after, the flood.
Mm-hmm.
After the time of creation. So it didn't take long for the age of man to decline to what we have today. Apparently from a mutation rate, we see that, it looks like maybe man isn't as old as we've been told. So this mutation, these mutation studies are very interesting. They did not show that, one, that you're going to create new information from mutations. Mm-hmm. Mutations destroy information, which is the key in the evolutionary creation story, because the evolutionists would say that mutations are beneficial and they create new information. A creationist would say, no, mutations destroy information that's in the DNA, and it causes an effect known as devolution. So it's going in the opposite direction.
This, on the scale of humanity, looks like death. This is a degradation to ultimate death. I mean, not with an individual, because, the multiple diseases, and there are new diseases popping up, and who knows whether or not they're caused by these successive mutations of mutations of mutations of mutations. But it seems we're becoming more and more vulnerable to things that can kill us. And if that's true, then we are, in fact, devolving.
Well, yes, we are. And I think, the evidence is quite clear that as far as mutations are concerned, that it's not adding one bit of benefit to man or the animals for that matter, but is actually going in the opposite direction, and ultimately we'll have so many mutations in our DNA that we won't even be able to survive. So I suppose that one could take the mutation rate per generation use that to say, okay, we've looked in one direction, that is, we looked in the past, let's look in the future and see how long are we going to be able to live like this, mm-hmm. with these mutations. And it wouldn't surprise me that that's not going to be very long in the future. Now, what do I mean by that? Is that going to be 10,000 years? Is it going to be, 20,000 years? Possibly. But it's not going to be hundreds of thousands of years, or even hundreds, of millions of years. We'll reach that stage of no return in our mutations, where there's so many mutations in the population that people aren't going to be able to survive, and so that would be an interesting study, actually an interesting calculation to do, to say, okay, how many mutations does it take in a population in order to pretty much wipe out the population.
Fascinating indeed. And
do you know if that's been done? Has anybody done those calculations?
I
was thinking the same thing. I've never heard of that, but if you can do the math backwards, you could certainly do it the other way.
But at what point does it stop? That would be an unknown. Now, this research that we're talking about in this article is recent, and I guess that over the last few years this study has been conducted, and so who knows? I would suspect that research is going on, but I think the obvious thing is that there needs to be a reconciliation, a restoration back to the way we were originally. And
what is that going to take? Who can do that?
Yeah. Not that many people that I know. I don't think John Sanford could do it.
I don't think so.
Right, but there is one person that can easily do it, and that's the creator of the universe, you know, Jesus himself. When he comes to restore the earth, if you will, you know, at the end, there'll be no more suffering, there'll be no more death, and there'll be no more tears, which means that, hey, our you know, if we have physical form, then our DNA is going to be completely repaired.
That'll be the day, and it goes back to my original assertion: they don't make them like they used to.
Yeah.
Now, talking with Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments, and I want to remind people of the website for Creation Moments is creationmoments.com, and there you will find a wealth of information that talks about the biblical story of creation. And it's not just information, it's not propaganda, it's not persuasion, it's scientific information. And I invite you to visit there. You can click on that Creation Moments icon over to the right-hand side of our homepage at BrokenRoadRadio.com. It'll take you there. And we're excited to see the new website, which will be coming out here shortly. Looking forward to that. David, I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have another thought there?
I had a really pithy thought.
Oh, good. Let her rip, Dave.
Not particularly pithy. It was just an underscore. Mm-hmm. The writer of the article, Tompkins, refers to the original article or the demonstration by Dr. Sanford at Cornell, and that was 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. So this is brand new.
Time's a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
The clock she be moving. We're clicking right along here.
Yeah, we are.
Mm-hmm. Ah, I mean, we're already 3 years past the discovery point. Wow.
On to the end. Well, or maybe on to the new beginning is the way I would prefer to look at it. Dr. Don Clark, thank you so much. We appreciate the time you spend with us every Tuesday morning, and we'll look forward to next week. So,
okay, very good. We'll hopefully you folks have a great week.
Well, tend the vineyard down there, and be well. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
So long.